desires, confused gropings that reach out blindly and you don't really know what they're reaching out for. Resistances to the truth, affective, psychic resistances, all of these things are the kind of thing that I'm talking about. I'm talking about complexes that disturb the relatively smooth performance of the subject as an intelligent, reasonable, responsible, loving person. They derail us from that search for direction in the movement of life. They get us off the track. And sometimes it feels like we're spending most of our energy getting back on the track. To the extent that those things are operative in us, our main concern is not staying on the track, but getting back on it. We are subject to being overpowered by these derailing sorts of emotional experiences. Because of these complexes, we are either unable or unwilling or perhaps both to function at some level of the creative vector. I am unable to pursue the questions that would lead me to the truth about myself or about a given situation. I just can't do it. I can't face that question yet. I might be willing, but unable. I might be unwilling. I might be both unable and unwilling. There's all kinds of possibilities. One time I tried to figure it out, how many there are, and I don't think that's important for our consideration here. But it's the question of inability and unwillingness, and there's a relative proportion of both at times. That at any rate, there's a breakdown of the creative vector. As Lonergan puts it, it becomes infected by bias. And that's not, again, imputing guilt. The bias can be something that I have no responsibility for developing in myself at all. We're going to get into that today. It's just there. It's in the way. The creative vector breaks down. It gets stuck somewhere along the way. And I find that I come to a dead end in my development. I can't get out of this cul-de-sac that I'm in. I can't get beyond it. Or at times I could get beyond it, but I don't want to for some strange, mysterious reason, the mystery of iniquity. So, in order for the creative vector to unfold smoothly, there has to be an affective freedom in the person. I must be affectively free, emotionally free, from the fears and desires, compulsions and obsessions, anxieties and wants that would lead to breakdown of the creative vector. That affective freedom, basically the way I understand the term detachment in the spiritual tradition of the church. Detachment is the affective freedom that enables my development and my contribution to others' development to unfold in a self-transcending fashion. Detachment is not indifference in the way in which we've come to use that word. Ignatius, St. Ignatius, uses the term indifference, but he doesn't mean I don't give a damn. That's not what indifference means. Detachment means that I am passionately committed to the true and the good. And everything else takes its proper place in terms of that passionate commitment to the true and the good. T.S. Eliot says there are three conditions that often look alike. I forget his exact words. Attachment to self and to things and to persons. Detachment from self and from things and from persons. And growing between them as a dead nettle between two live nettles, indifference. Indifference is death. Attachment and detachment are both life. So by detachment, I'm talking about a passionate commitment to the true and the good. And everything else is relativized by that passionate commitment to the true and the good. Detachment from lesser concerns. This is what Ignatius means, and those of you who have a background in the spiritual exercises, that freedom from inordinate affections. Inordinate affections are affections, affectivity, affective complexes, that derail the person from the search for direction of life. Get you off the track. Inordinate. Now again, to say inordinate is not to say you're to blame for them. We'll see in great detail, and it's one of the great insights of depth psychology in the 20th century. Many of these, you had nothing to do. They're developed. They were implanted in you from time in your life where you had no responsibility for what was happening to you at all. But affective development, then, I think, is a matter of coming to that passionate commitment to the true and the good, so that I rejoice in the true and the good, and I want those more than anything else. Affective development means that I desire, that's term that's loaded with affective meaning. I desire what the questions of the human spirit are after. Intelligibility, truth, real value, and love. I really desire that. Spontaneously, want it. That would be an affectively developed person. Where desire matches the reach of my question. Again, Eliot speaks at the end of the four quartets of the condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. Where the tongues of flame are enfolded, all of these inordinate affections, the tongues of flame, are enfolded into the crowned knot of fire, where I'm passionately committed to what is true and good. And the fire and the rose, my earthly being, are one. That's exactly what he's getting at there. The condition of complete simplicity costing not less than everything. It's that detachment, so that I am passionately committed to what is true and good, or to the objectives of those levels of consciousness. Meaning, truth, real value, love. So psychotherapy, if this is at all on the track, what I'm presenting here, if it's at all on the track, real healing of the psyche is the healing of those complexes that are in the way of that passionate commitment to the true and the good, that are in the way of that spontaneous performance of the operations by which I find what is true and good. Real psychotherapy, real healing of the psyche is the healing of those blocks that prevent me from being the self-transcendent subject that my capacities as a questioning spirit would enable me to be. Now that's a first approximation of what real psychotherapy, real healing of the psyche would be. We'll fill it out in more detail as we go along. It's what Lonergan would call a heuristic notion of saying what it would be, but what it is has to be filled out by the concrete details of a given case. At least I can say this much, that my psyche is in the process of being healed if I find that I am more spontaneously able to desire what is really true and what is really good in myself and in the world that I affect by my actions. the more that I spontaneously desire that, the more my psyche is being healed. So it's a heuristic notion of what psychotherapy, real psychotherapy, would be. There's a story that goes around about the difference between Freudian and Jungian psychotherapy. Maybe you've heard of it. Goes like this, that in Freudian therapy, after you've been in it for a while, you still feel miserable, but your friends think you're doing much better. Whereas in Jungian therapy, after you've been in it for a while, you feel great, but your friends think you're crazier than you ever were. It's a certain amount of truth. Okay. Disordered complexes as victims, number 2A3. How are these disordered complexes formed? I think the truest thing that can be said about them is that they are victims. They are not in themselves responsible for their own disorder. The psyche is spontaneous, and its disorder is caused by something other than itself, if it is disorder. It might be caused by others, family. My earliest years as a child in the family. It can be caused by myself, my freedom. I can mistreat myself. But it's not the spontaneous psyche that is responsible in any kind of, where you can apply moral guilt to the disorder. I might be able to apply moral guilt to what I have freely chosen to do. And what I have freely chosen to do hurts the psyche. But the psyche itself is a victim, either of others or of myself. Or to put it more fully, the way I like to express it this way is that these disordered complexes are the victims of history and social injustice or family or other, maybe significant others in my life being hurt, or myself. In any case, I mean, frequently it's a combination of some of those that's responsible for the disorder in the person's psyche. They're not exclusive of one another. But the complex is a victim. It didn't get itself into the mess that it's in. The psychic complex is not responsible for its own genesis. The genesis of its own disorder. History and social injustice, for instance, can set up certain conditions that affect the family into which I am born. And the affective health of mother and father and their own affective health affects me in my earliest years, and in fact from the womb, with my having no say over what is happening to me. This is just one scenario. There are many different possible scenarios here of how a given individual's psyche can be victimized by history and so on. One scenario is that the social injustice sets up affective conditions that are unhealthy for the family and so on and so forth. And you get into the kind of thing where you have actually generational bondage, where a family, for instance, is affected over generations by the same pattern, the same psychic pattern. I was made aware of this in the case of my own family history. Through reflection on it and so on and so forth, but also through, real exploration of it, of a long history of frustrated creativity. Which goes back, you know, I could be aware of it in both my parents, because they were both intelligent people and poor at the same time. And neither one of them had the opportunity for an education beyond the eighth grade. And that was a frustration for both of them. That there was all kinds of creative energy and intelligence that never, never got an outlet, you see. But then as I came to find out more and more, the family, find that pattern goes back generations of frustrated creativity passed on, you see. All right, that is going to affect the psyche of a person born into that family without that person doing anything to say. No responsibility for it there at all. So, at least you can say this much, and this is where the psychoanalysts and so on are right on target. The complexes of our psychic energy are set for us from the womb. Some of the details are set for us from the womb. The very way in which we were conceived. Was I conceived in love? Makes a difference. And the psychic complexes of my parents were set for them from their womb. Etc., etc., etc. The whole thing that's operating in the generations of the family that are passed on. And it's in that sense, that at least in that sense, and then when you introduce the whole thing of social injustice and so on and so forth coming in and making that thing even more complex, you see, okay, you get a notion, at least I hope, of what I mean by victim. That there are victimized aspects of my own psyche that I had nothing to do with. And they reach back beyond even my memory. How was I treated as an infant before I can even remember? What was going on in that whole period of coming into, you know, the psychiatrists talk about, it's a very important thing, of toilet training. What was going on there? I don't remember that. What was happening in terms of a whole relationship to the body? There can be psychic blocks that are established at that point in a person's history, coming to despise the body at that point, for instance, that I had nothing to do with, I can't even remember it. Now, other psychic complexes can be established, however, by my own mistreatment of myself. I can perform certain actions that are self-destructive, and freely perform. And as I'm doing that, I am destroying my own psyche. So there, I don't want to say that it's all rests on other people's shoulders, but even then, the psyche is victim of myself, of my own stupidity, my own irrationality, my own selfishness, or whatever. Psyche is victim. Now, I would say this much. With regard to those that are established in ourselves by others, back where we can't remember, Freud is right, up to a certain extent, that a lot of that has to do with sexuality, genitality, and the body. I'm convinced that that's true. I don't think it's exclusively that sort of thing as he would want to make it be. But I think that my relationship to my own body, a lot of that is established in those early years as my body is handled and touched and felt. And as I learn to develop various functions of the body before I can even remember, and certainly before I have any free say over how that's going to go on, how that's going to happen, I think he's absolutely correct that there are sexual disorders, if you want, or that can begin at that point. Confusion of the whole area of sexuality. He's correct. I don't think it's quite the way he says it is, that, you know, the child is seeking for sexual union with the parent of the opposite sex and so on. At that point, it's getting into myth. But the fact that sexual confusion, complexes that have to do with genitality can be established that early, I think he's right. And I would indicate also that if you want to read an excellent treatment of how I can contribute to forming disordered complexes in myself, I would suggest reading Sebastian Moore's The Crucified Jesus as No Stranger. That's how I victimize myself. That's why The Crucified Jesus is No Stranger, because I crucify myself. In crucifying myself, I can relate to what the world has done in crucifying Jesus, in his crucified life. At any rate, that's a powerful book. If you read Moore, you have to read it as a meditation book. Don't speed read it. It's a meditation book. It looks easy because the chapters are about 2 pages long, but you can spend hours on 2 pages there. But that's what he's getting at. Sebastian Moore, M-O-O-R-E, The Crucified Jesus is No Stranger. All right, now I want to talk about both of these, but I want to talk about these victimized complexes and how they interfere in my own... unfolding my own person. The emotional blocks that come from my earliest years, where I had nothing to do about them, are really what, for those of you who have read or are reading Lonergan, that's what he's talking about when he talks in chapter 6 of Insight about dramatic bias. Emotional obstacles that are just simply there. I didn't have any choice about their development in myself at all. And as he correctly indicates, many of these have to do with sexuality, not all. My whole relationship to my own body and the bodies of others. Great deal of confusion and so on. But what he's getting at when he talks about dramatic bias are those emotional blocks that are there because somehow I have been victimized by my history in my earliest years without any say over it myself. And in the next chapter where he talks about egoistic group and general bias, he's talking about emotional obstacles, in part at least, he's talking about emotional obstacles that I have some part in. I created these myself. At least I find that as a helpful distinction, but that's mainly for those people that are using his terminology. So, first of all then, with regard to these obstacles that are outside of my control as far as their Genesis is concerned. I've covered everything right here. Oh, yes. First thing that I would want to say with regard to them is how do we get at them? Frequently, their roots can only be discovered through a process of depth psychological analysis. It takes us back to our earliest years, and sometimes even beyond what we're capable of remembering, the roots of them. Our dreams can bring us back at times, and maybe you've had, this is not a frequent experience, but a dream that takes you back to beyond your earliest memory. Because the whole thing is still there, it's stored up in the psyche. Now, it's very important, this is a practical caution, do not try to dig up the roots prematurely. The deep well of the past. It's a tremendous mistake. Let the psyche provide you what you need to understand yourself and your own development. if you need to get back to something that happened to you before you can even remember, the psyche will give it. If you don't need it, then don't worry about it. Deal with what you're working with right now.